at a time when they're wondering and they're really panicking, and the ratings are just going down. I mean, the ratings are plummeting for this company. And they'll have a rebound week and all that, but look at the base average for Raw now. I mean, before you give it another 6 months, and it's going to be normal for Raw to get a 2.8. And there'll be a Raw 6 or 9 months from now that gets a 2.5, and they're going to freak out, and then Raw will shoot back up to a 2.8, and they'll be happy. That's the baseline now. I mean, that's kind of the peak that we've reached. It's not about a 3 or a 3.4 or a 3.5. Fewer and fewer people are interested in watching the product, and you wonder why. Welcome to episode 248 of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, December 2nd, 2012. I am the Solemn Monster. That was a clip you heard there at the top of the show from Sound Off 222 back on June 10th of this year. One of our listeners, Adrian, pointed it out to me, and I thought it would be rather prophetic to play that this week with Raw sinking to new lows, pulling a 2.7 rating this week with each hour lower than the one before it. Starting with a 2.9, then falling to a 2.8, and a disastrous 2.5 for the third and final hour. That is scary, is what that is. And, you know, you heard there in June, I predicted that within 6 months, a 2.8 would become the norm for Raw. And, you know, I hate to say I told you so, but next week marks exactly 6 months since I recorded that show, and look at where we are. You know, and not only that, they did get a 2.5 for that 1 hour at least, and they are freaking out. The question is, how do they react to it? That's the question coming off Raw this past week. There's no major excuse. There was no award show. There was no big football game or anything like that. Raw just did not do very well this past week. And I posted a question on Twitter several days ago, kind of a rhetorical question, really, just to get some feedback from you guys to see what you think. And the question was, would CM Punk, who has now been WWE champion for over a year, he passed Macho Man Randy Savage's record of 371 days, he's well on his way to crushing John Cena's record of 380, and that's all well and good, but would CM Punk still be WWE champion right now for more than a year, presumably face him in a match for the championship next month at the Royal Rumble? I think it's a valid question. You know, WWE had The Rock go out there on the 1,000th Raw back in July, and they said, listen, Rock is getting a title shot in January, and they very strongly teased that that match would be Rock versus Punk. Now, they could certainly change their minds. They could freak out, put the title on Ryback at TLC. I don't see that happening. But the plan all along has been to put Rock in there with CM Punk. And I think that's a big match. I'm looking forward to it, quite frankly. I think that's a big-time match to have on a non-WrestleMania pay-per-view. I'm looking forward to the Royal Rumble. I'm looking forward to seeing Rock vs. Punk for the very first time. But it's a valid question that if they didn't have that long-term plan in place, would they still keep the ball with CM Punk? Or would they have stripped the ball from him a long time ago? They've done that before. Done title changes because of, you know, a rating went down when it should have gone up and lost faith in people, put the blame squarely on their shoulders. Does CM Punk deserve the blame for where WWE is right now, for where Raw is right now? I mean, personally, I think it would be unfair to put the blame all on CM Punk because I think the biggest reason Raw is where it is right now is the fact that it's 3 hours, and 3 hours is just too long. I mean, that's why people are tuning out at the end of the show, but the fact is CM Punk has never really been a big, ratings draw, whatever that means, here in 2012. I mean, people ask me all the time, what is the significance of TV ratings? You know, Nitro is long dead and buried. There is no competition on Monday nights anymore between two wrestling companies. Why are the ratings so important? The reason the ratings are so important is because it's important to the TV network. It's important to USA Network. They rely on Raw to do well, so that it boosts their station average, and they can be listed as the number one cable network on TV each week. You know, they get a lot of competition from ESPN. They get a lot of competition from FX, from TNT. They want to be number one, and Raw is their flagship show. Whether they like to admit that or not, You know, they can tout all of their other shows, you know, Burn Notice, and I know a lot of those shows are very successful, but, you know, wrestling consistently delivers big-time ratings for USA. That's why it's so important. You know, Vince McMahon does not want a situation to occur where next year, the year after, when their television contract comes up for Raw, you know, USA takes a look at it and says, wait a minute, you know, this show isn't doing quite as well as it did when we first signed this deal a couple of years ago, and we don't want to pay you as much money each week for the rights to Raw as we're doing. Or maybe they just ditch Raw altogether. They just say, you know what, it's not worth having wrestling on this network anymore. We tolerated having wrestling on our network because it helped our station average, but now, not so much, so adios. And they kick them to the curb. I think it's unlikely that would happen, but can you imagine if USA kicked Raw to the curb? That would not be good. And Vince has talked before, one of the reasons for starting this new network is so that they can be self-sufficient. So if that ever occurred, well, they have a television network where they can put their programming on. But you have a television network that may never launch. There's still no clear-cut answer when this new WWE network is going to launch. So the last thing they need is for USA to kind of fall out of favor with them. So that's why the ratings are still very important. That's why they still live and die by those quarter-hour numbers and why I mention them. They weren't important, I wouldn't mention them. So anyway, it's just an interesting question when it comes to CM Punk and the fact that he has been champion for this long. Quite frankly, I find it shocking that they have stuck with him this long. I'm not blaming him at all. I think Punk, as I said on Twitter, I think Punk has done a tremendous job as the champion, both when he was a babyface and then through the heel turn. Him and Paul Heyman are the most entertaining act right now in WWE. I think as a heel, I think in his role, he's excellent. I don't think he could be doing any better. As far as his performances and what we see on TV every week, it's just not translating in the numbers. And Punk matches have never really translated in the numbers, even back when he was a babyface, even back before he was champion. It's not like Punk was some big ratings draw. So he does deserve a little bit of criticism, but I think, you know, saying that, well, it's all CM Punk's fault, they should take the title off him and put it back on John Cena, that's not the answer. You know, that's the antithesis of what I think the answer is. That's the opposite of what I think the answer is. But just interesting to see, you know, what I was talking about here on the show 6 months ago, and here we are just about 6 months later, and we're exactly where I figured we would be at this point. 3 hours is just killing this show. Speaking of Raw, Raw was from Lafayette, Louisiana this past Monday night. I had the great pleasure of watching Raw in the company of not only Noah Mark and Brian Blade, who you may know, but Webmaster Mike as well. A rare trip back to New York for Webmaster Mike. The Horsemen ride again for the first time since WrestleMania in Miami. And there was actually a group of about 8 of us down in Brian Blade's underground bunker watching Raw on the big screen. And I'm not going to lie, we really only paid attention to about half the show. I had to go back and rewatch certain segments that I missed. We were just having way too much fun texting funny and in some cases rather disturbing wrestling photos to one another. Come to think of it, 95% of the photos were related in some way to Hulk Hogan. One of Brian's friends, Chad, is the ultimate Hulkamaniac. I mean, he would take a bullet for the guy, then pull it out and ask him to sign it. That's a real fan right there. Anyway, we're laughing at these dumb photos, and there's this one image with Brooke Hogan and her father, but their faces are transplanted onto each other's bodies. And this photo still gives me nightmares just thinking about it. It's up on my Twitter, at Solomonster, if you want to go back and check it out. I'm giving you fair warning, though. It's kind of disturbing. Actually, my favorite one of the bunch may have been Hulk Hogan with the Fu Manchu eyebrows. I lost my shit when I saw that. So we had a contest going to see who would be the first person to fall asleep during the show, and poor Noah, he lost the contest, or won, depends on how you look at it, I suppose. Passed out early on during the third hour. I have photographic evidence of this on my Twitter page. He wasn't the only one who lost interest during that third hour. I was talking about the ratings before. There were nearly 700,000 people who tuned that show out. They tuned out of Raw. They turned it off during the third and final hour on Monday night, which is practically unheard of to have that many people turning it off. You know, 3 hours is, it is what it is. It's just absolutely crippling them. And it was a shame, too, because there was some good wrestling during that third hour, including a damn fine match between Sheamus and Antonio Cesaro. You know, Brian and I were talking about this, actually, how Sheamus has quietly become an MVP performer for them, at least on the Raw brand, which is funny because he's technically a SmackDown star. The guy has had some great matches on Raw this year against, you know, Daniel Bryan, Wade Barrett, now Cesaro, just to name a few. He's a very good big man wrestler. I've said before, I like how he's got lots of different signature moves that he's incorporated into his arsenal. A lot of people just use the same one or two moves over and over again, and Sheamus, you know, although he doesn't really use that running razor's edge anymore, but still, he's got a lot of different moves that he relies on. He doesn't just kick people in the face and that's it. He's got the bro kick, he's got white noise, he's got the little backbreaker, he's got all these different things. He's very, very good, and when you put him in there with somebody like Cesaro, it should be no surprise that you're going to end up with a great match. But I thought this was a fun show overall, probably more so because I had seven other people to watch it with, and it's always going to be more fun in a group setting. So let's just run through this show. Got a lot of thoughts on it. Ryback opened Raw with a quick win over Titus O'Neil. The dude hit it out of the park on commentary last week. Titus did. He was very entertaining, and so this week they feed him to Ryback. I mean, was that really necessary? You couldn't find anybody else on the roster to put in this spot. I mean, hell, Darren Young is out there doing nothing. He's got the little pick in his hair. Why not put him in there? I called this a squash initially when it happened. Noah argued that it was not a squash because they actually gave Titus some offense, and upon going back and watching this match over again, I would agree that it was not a squash. Noah was correct, but it was one level up from a squash because of how short it was. Ryback refused to leave the ring after winning until he got his hands on the NXT guys that had been kicking his ass. This brought out a bunch of indie wrestlers dressed up very poorly to convince us that they were actually security guards. Ryback made short work of them. This brought out Vicky Guerrero. Ryback actually cut her off a few times in the mic, told her to shut up, which I thought was great. I thought Ryback on the mic this week was so much better than he was the week before. He just sounded more natural here. He didn't sound like he was, you know, reciting something from a piece of paper. He demanded a TLC match against Punk at the next pay-per-view. Vicky acquiesced to his demands. That means she accepted his demands. Relented. This was changed because I can tell you this. Locally here in Brooklyn, they've been running ads here for the TLC pay-per-view that had Ryback and Punk listed in a tables match and Cena versus Ziggler in a TLC match. So when I mentioned that on the sound-off last week, I was only relaying what I was told. That was the plan, obviously, at one point. They changed their minds, so now it's Ryback and Punk in a TLC match. I don't know about Ryback climbing ladders, but it is what it is. Alberto Del Rio beat the great Kali with the cross-arm breaker. Not to be confused with the Aces and Eights arm breaker in TNA. Speaking of Del Rio, just a funny little aside here. Brian's lovely wife, Robin, made a brief cameo appearance while we were watching the show, and I learned that her favorite wrestler is CM Punk. And her least favorite wrestler, take one guess, Alberto Del Rio. Now, why? Because he's an evil, scummy person. When I heard this, my first thought was, let me see if I understand this correct. You hate Del Rio because he's such a bad guy. Yet CM Punk is your favorite wrestler. The same CM Punk who told Jerry Lawler, fresh off a return from a heart attack, that he was going to beat him to death. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I had that right. I kid, Robin. Backstage, Vicky Guerrero made the main event a Raw active match, where the fans would get to vote on who CM Punk's opponent would be, either Daniel Bryan or Kane. And when I heard Daniel Bryan's name mentioned, I had hope. I had hope that the fans would do the right thing, and suffice to say, they let me down. The WWE Universe is a sad place. Actually, it probably isn't really so much a sad place as much as WWE is a sad place, and I'll talk more about this supposed voting in a few minutes. We'll get back to that. Then came what I was most looking forward to on this show, Michael Cole's interview with the NXT 3, Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Roman Reigns. And let me just say, I really, really like the fact that it was a pre-taped sit-down interview backstage and not just the three of them standing around in the middle of the ring. These types of interviews have so much more impact to me. You know, Jim Ross interviewing Mick Foley back in 97 for that famous Three Faces of Foley interview. which I actually think was three parts to it. But, you know, unfortunately, poor JR ended up getting the mandible claw at the end of it. But that was a very good interview. That was kind of his coming out interview. As I understand it, if I remember history correctly, that was the interview that really opened Vince McMahon's eyes to the kind of star that Mick Foley could be. It just gave so much more depth to the Mankind character. You know, Jim Ross interviewing Triple H back in 99 when he did that work shoot. They were kind of sitting, he was sitting on a couch looking right in JR's face and going off on him, blaming him for what happened after the curtain call incident at MSG back in 96. You know, JR was part of management, Triple H. We all know the story. You know, it was Kevin Nash and Scott Hall's last night, and they all embraced, you know, with Shawn Michaels, Triple H came out. And again, some were faces, some were heels. This is not the sort of thing you saw back then. They were breaking kayfabe, and they all embraced. One last big group hug in the middle of the ring, and there's different stories about who complained to management about it. Bret Hart supposedly complained to management about how they were, you know, killing the business or whatever. And the person who got punished for it was Triple H, because Shawn Michaels was the champion. They weren't going to do shit to him. And Hall and Nash were already on their way out to WCW. So Triple H got punished for it. He was supposed to win the King of the Ring in 96, and he didn't. He ended up winning it a year later, which paved the way for some other person by the name of Steve Austin, something or other, who won King of the Ring that year. I wonder whatever happened to him. Anyway, that was a great interview. There was a really good sit-down, face-to-face interview with Undertaker and Brock Lesnar that I think a lot of people don't remember on SmackDown back during their feud. I want to say that was in 2003, because Stephanie was the GM, and she was in the room in the background. That was also very good. So I could rattle off others. You get the picture here. I love these types of interviews. We don't need the crowd noise. You know, and more importantly, we don't need the goddamn what chants. That chant has single-handedly ruined wrestling. And to think that some people actually thought the yes chant earlier this year would kill off the what chants. I wish it had. But the thing is here to stay. Not that these guys, you know, Ambrose in particular, who's very good, couldn't handle it. I think he probably could have handled it just fine, but, you know, even if it doesn't rattle the wrestlers, even if they can handle the what chant, if they could ignore it, it just takes the crowd out of it. You know, it turns the whole thing into a joke. This segment was not designed to be a joke. So I liked the format, and I thought they handled it very well. Ambrose did most of the talking, which is the right move. He's the best talker of the three. This reminded me a little bit of Eric Bischoff interviewing Scott Hall and Kevin Nash at the Great American Bash back in 96. Right after they came in. They didn't even have the NWO name yet. They had been sued. WCW had been sued by WWF for misleading the fans into thinking that two WWF contracted talents had actually invaded WCW for real. So Bischoff had to go on TV and specifically ask them point blank, do you guys work for the WWF? And they both said no. Here, you had Michael Cole asking them point blank if they were working for the WWE champion, CM Punk. And they said no. And interestingly, Cole did not ask them if they were working for Paul Heyman, only for CM Punk. So that may be their out there if it's revealed later on that they actually are working on Heyman's behalf. I don't know if anybody else caught that or not. They said that they were a shield against injustice. It wasn't right that CM Punk had to defend this title against both Ryback and John Cena at Survivor Series since he had beaten them before. Ambrose said if the roles were reversed and it was Ryback defending the championship, then they would have intervened on his behalf. So it appears that the Shield name I talked about last week is the name they're going with for these guys, and I like it. You know, I like the name. Roman Reigns said very little, so it looks like he'll be the silent but deadly enforcer of the group, which I figured. You know, they've got something here with these guys. My advice to them, quite simple. Don't fuck it up. But I do think at some point soon they need to reveal the relationship with them and Heyman. I think they need to be linked with Paul Heyman in some way. How Brad Maddox figures into this whole equation is another interesting question. Maybe they reveal that they were actually working on behalf of Maddox, who in turn is working for Heyman. Remember, on that Raw show where Maddox got killed by Ryback, there was a backstage segment where Heyman pulled him aside to talk to him, and it was never mentioned again. So I would like to think there was a reason behind it. It wasn't just some random segment to swerve everybody. But maybe there was some long-term thinking behind that, and you know, in the next couple of weeks, as this story plays itself out, we'll figure out what the connection is there. Tamina beat Alicia Fox, time on the Diva stopwatch, a cool 2 minutes and 6 seconds. Everyone in the Man Cave, by the way, this week was very excited to see me bust out the Diva stopwatch. Brian Blade attempted to do his own version of the Diva stopwatch, but, you know, it's like when you make a photocopy of something, the copy is never as good as the original, so sorry, buddy, it just doesn't work. I'm not going to bother recapping this next segment because we were bullshitting through most of it. I didn't care enough to go back and rewatch it. All you need to know is that Vicky Guerrero made a match for this show of John Cena versus Dolph Ziggler. John Cena versus Dolph Ziggler for free on Raw with absolutely zero promotion in advance. A match that I had just foolishly assumed would be added to the TLC pay-per-view, where I will be very excited to see Ziggler, facing the top star in the company. Apparently I was wrong. And it wasn't even the main event. That's the whole thing. This wasn't even the main event of Monday Night Raw. Amazing. Kofi Kingston pinned Lord Job Guy with a crossbody off the top. Yep, a crossbody. Poor guy. Wade Barrett was doing commentary. He may have been good, he may have not been. I don't know. Again, we were just talking over him the whole match, entertaining ourselves. He handed Kofi the Intercontinental title after the match and walked away without incident. So, it was awfully nice of him. Backstage, we found out the winner of tonight's Raw Active Twitter poll. And if you guessed that the fans voted to see CM Punk versus Daniel Bryan, well, you'd be wrong. No, they voted for CM Punk versus Kane as our main event. 59-41%. Now, let me just address this whole voting situation. A lot of people don't believe for a second that this Twitter voting is real. And frankly, after this, I think they're right. The fans, I just refuse to believe the fans can possibly be this stupid. Plus, it was awfully convenient for them to book a segment where Brian was mocking Kane by showing him a map of the U.S. and a map of the world that showed everybody voting for him and not Kane. And then miraculously, we find out that Kane actually won, so Brian, of course, is made to look like a fool. I call bullshit on this whole thing, and I firmly believe this poll was rigged. PW Insider has sources in WWE that swear the results are 100% legitimate. I don't believe them. I think those sources are lying. There was even a link that Daniel Bryan himself posted on his Twitter page where they show it's like statistics that are somehow related to hashtags in some way, and Bryan clearly defeated Kane. In terms of the hashtags that you were supposed to put in and all that crap, however that works. So, you know, maybe some of their polls are legit, but this one was not. And you cannot convince me otherwise. Now, we did get a Rey Mysterio-Daniel Bryan match out of it, and it was pretty good. I actually thought it was kind of disappointing, quite frankly. I don't know. I mean, I guess I was expecting more from a first-time match between these two guys. But it was good. Mysterio won with a splash off the top. I'd like to see more from them in the future. I think they could put on a much better match. Dolph Ziggler and John Cena, which, again, should have been saved for TLC. Nonetheless, they went out there, and they actually had a really good match. I actually thought it was even better than Mysterio and Bryan. Pretty long match, too. When they first announced this, Noah predicted that we would not even get the match. He was convinced there was just no way they would just give it away like this. And I told him he was wrong, and I was right. They had a very long match. Cena went for a five-knuckle shuffle. His injured leg, if you remember his bum knee, appeared to buckle. He rolled to the outside. Doctors rushed over to see if he could continue the match. So Dolph, while that was going on, he tried to remove one of the turnbuckle pads. AJ came out to stop him. Vicky came out to confront AJ on the outside. Ziggler grabbed his Money in the Bank briefcase and tried to nail Cena with it. He missed. Cena nailed the AA and got the pin. 1-2-3, just like that. He pinned Dolph Ziggler clean in the middle of the ring on Raw. I don't get it either. Don't even ask me. You know, now they expect people to pay to see them have a rematch on pay-per-view. I mean, that was my first thought. And we don't even know what the plan is at all. They haven't announced that they're going to have a singles match. We don't know. As of right now, John Cena and Dolph Ziggler are two men without a match on the next pay-per-view. And to me, this finish here, It makes no sense unless AJ is turning on Cena and siding with Dolph, and it just seems way too early for that. And, you know, afterwards, Cena and AJ, they celebrated, they made out in the ring. Cena so clearly does not want to kiss this woman, and I guess now we know why with those pictures that popped up of him with Nikki Bella. Aside from AJ turning heel on Cena, potentially. The only thing I could figure for the pay-per-view is that they're going to go with a mixed tag match, maybe. Have Cena and AJ against Dolph and Tamina, who is Vicky's hired gun. I mean, I guess they could put Vicky in there, but I would think they would put Tamina since Tamina can actually wrestle. You know, I've seen the rumors online on certain websites about them possibly doing a Ziggler versus Cena ladder match with Ziggler's Money in the Bank briefcase on the line. Let's hope Ziggler isn't stupid enough in storyline to actually agree to such a dumb stipulation. I mean, I think if John Cena beat Dolph Ziggler a second straight time and won the briefcase from him, the internet would explode. I think the internet would just implode onto itself if that actually happened, and that would be a very dumb thing for them to do. Then came my favorite match of the night, Sheamus and Antonio Cesaro. I said earlier how much I love this match. Cesaro is deceptively strong. He is a strong man. And actually got Sheamus up for the Alpha Mare water slide, which kind of, the Alpha Mare water slide is a move that kind of resembles almost a reverse Death Valley driver, is how I would describe it. He's used this move before in the past. It's no easy feat getting a big guy like Sheamus up the way that Cesaro did. I'm just waiting for Cesaro to really go old school and bust out a giant swing during one of his matches that I used to see back in the ROH days. But as impressive as that move was, it was nothing. It was nothing compared to that uppercut that he nailed later in the match. I've made no bones about the fact here on this show that I greatly dislike his finisher, the neutralizer, and I think he should be using his uppercut as his finisher. This match is proof of why I'm right. When he nailed Sheamus coming off the top rope with that uppercut, our entire room erupted. I mean, we actually had to go back and rewind it just so we could watch it again. It even woke Noah up briefly from his slumber. Just brutal, brutal stuff. I loved it. Just absolutely loved this match. Sheamus caught Cesaro with a pretty weak-looking brogue kick, knocked him out to the floor, and he got counted out, which I was fine with because they didn't feel the need to beat Cesaro clean like they do pretty much everybody else that Sheamus faced. I mean, he fought Damian Sandow last week, beat him clean. How many goddamn times has he beaten Dolph Ziggler clean, for Christ's sake? But they did not beat Cesaro clean. And I think that's a plus. I think that's a positive right there. They obviously see something in the guy, and they should. He's very, very good. Big Show came out to distract Sheamus. So, you know, most people weren't even paying attention to the fact that Cesaro got counted out. I heard the bell ring in the background, but by no means did the announcers or the cameras or anything put any focus on Cesaro getting counted out, which is also a good thing. I don't even know that most people realize he lost the match. I think they figured the match just kind of ended. It was almost like they were protecting him even in defeat. So I'd love to see these guys work more in the future, but in an actual program. I don't want to just see them in some random match on Raw, some random match on SmackDown. Much like Sheamus and Wade Barrett, who have great matches, I could see potentially them feuding over the world title in the future. I could see the same thing for Sheamus and Cesaro down the road. And I'd like to see that, actually. Damian Sandow, whose partner Cody Rhodes likely will not be back in action until sometime in January, possibly by the Royal Rumble. He's still recovering from injuries he sustained off that botched backdrop a couple of weeks ago by Kane on Main Event. Sandow beat Zack Ryder, who was wearing Ghostbuster tights and knee pads. Why? I have no idea. I know he's a fan of the Ghostbusters. I do still sometimes watch his YouTube show, so I'm aware of that. But so what, buddy? They were promoting his match with John Cena on Main Event, and you can pretty much figure how that went. CM Punk and Kane was our main event. This was a boring match. The Shield came out of the crowd to distract Kane, which gave Punk the chance to hoist him up and deliver the GTS for the pin. After the match, the Shield, they teased going after Punk, then they started beating on Kane instead. Daniel Bryan ran out. He got beaten up as well. Ryback ran out, or as Daniel Bryan would call him, the Ryback. And Punk bailed, Shield went after Ryback, he fought back, beat the shit out of all three of them, which is fine. They've laid Ryback out the last 2 weeks, it was time for him to get some revenge. Punk returned, Ryback got him up for a powerbomb, Roman Reigns speared him, everybody just collapsed in a heap on top of one another. The Shield teamed up for another one of those triple team powerbombs on Ryback, and CM Punk was left standing tall with the title to close out the show, so it was fun to watch this in the company of others, but still, 3 hours gets very old very fast. I think that is the theme of Raw every single week. Probably doesn't need to be said over and over again, but I will continue to say it because it's true. Outdoing for WrestleMania. By no means are these matches set in stone. I mean, this is WWE after all that we're talking about, but Anybody who doesn't want any WrestleMania spoilers, first of all, if you're on the internet and you go to wrestling sites, good luck. You can't avoid stuff like this, but if you don't want to listen to it, skip this part. According to the latest Wrestling Observer newsletter, it looks as though The Undertaker will not be skipping WrestleMania next year. He will have a match. His most likely opponent being discussed right now is CM Punk. And it would be a high-profile match for Punk on the biggest show of the year. I don't know how happy he would be, really, working with The Undertaker. Just based on comments that Punk has made before in interviews, I'm not sure how thrilled he really was working with him back in 2009. You know, I don't remember them having particularly good matches together. I mean, maybe they were good, they weren't great. And obviously Punk would be losing here. Anybody who faces Undertaker at WrestleMania is losing. I mean, that's just how it is. And, you know, there's no way that Punk breaks the streak. The reality is, if you take the title off CM Punk and you go with Rock versus John Cena 2, this probably is the biggest match they could do with Punk, short of getting Steve Austin to come back for that show. I'd rather see Undertaker versus Brock Lesnar, personally. I get, though, that they're going to want to do Lesnar Triple H Part 2. And someone like Wade Barrett, for example. I love Wade Barrett. I wouldn't mind seeing him and Sheamus meet for the world title, like I said before. I could see Barrett even being a dark horse pick to win the Royal Rumble. But I just don't have any interest at all in seeing Wade Barrett challenge The Undertaker. Or any other young guy, quite frankly. I just don't think it's a good spot for them right now. I think Undertaker has so few matches left. I really could see him wrestling next year and then 30, and that's it. So let's say that Undertaker has two matches left in his broken-down body. I don't want to see them wasted on some young guy that's just inevitably going to lose to him anyway. So I guess Punk would probably be the best option. Another potential match WWE may be looking at for Mania would have Ryback facing the Big Show, with the thought being that Ryback could get Big Show up on his shoulders for the shell shock. He could march around the ring with him. I admit, I mean, that would be quite the visual if he could pull it off. That's the question, though. Can he pull it off? I mean, God, I mean, if he can't pick Big Show up, it'll be Brock Lesnar's shooting star press at WrestleMania 19 all over again. Ryback had trouble with Tenzai not too long ago. I don't know about relying on him being able to lift a man who's at least 100 pounds heavier. Especially, consider this. It's not like he's just going to walk in there, pick Big Show up, and squash him in 30 seconds. Although I would argue that that's exactly how they should book that if they really want to have Ryback make an impact on the biggest show of the year. You know, Big Show was once willing to put over a young CM Punk in an Elimination Chamber match in the first 2 minutes by tap out, no less. Okay, Big Show was willing to do it, and Vince said no, but I don't know that Big Show would necessarily have a problem doing that, you know, getting in there with Ryback and losing in 30 seconds if he thought it was good for business. But assuming that does not happen, remember, Ryback in a match is going to be tired. Both guys are going to be tired. They're going to be sweaty from wrestling a match before he ever tries to pick the Big Show up. It's a risky proposition to ask him to pick this guy up on his shoulders and not drop him. But, you know, if he could pull it off, it would certainly be a WrestleMania moment. So that's another match, apparently, that they are discussing. And as we've talked about before, the plan at this point is still Rock versus Cena, I guess, twice in a lifetime would be your WrestleMania main event next year. We'll see if they stick to the plan or not. The Ascension is no longer the Ascension, I guess, on NXT. One of the members of The Ascension, which was that tag team, they were kind of the gothic tag team down in NXT. One of the members, Kenneth Cameron, was his gimmick name. He was released by WWE this past week. He was arrested on Thanksgiving Eve and charged with battery on a law enforcement officer and public intoxication. That's a no-no. He had an earlier arrest for DUI, so this was not an isolated incident. His name was removed from the NXT website. There had been no confirmation until late Friday, and then came confirmation that he was, in fact, gone from the company. And, you know, that's a real shame. His tag team with Conor O'Brien had a lot of buzz around them for months, and probably would have been part of the next round of call-ups to the main roster, my guess would be. And with WWE's renewed emphasis on tag team wrestling of late, they could have easily been plugged into that whole scene and probably would have ended up with the titles at some point. And poor Connor O'Brien gets fucked over now. I feel bad for the guy. I mean, that's the risk you run when you're part of a tag team. You know, you could do everything to stay on the straight and narrow and not cause any trouble, but you're linked with somebody else. And when they screw up, it affects you just the same. And I think that's kind of where he finds himself now. I don't know if they could just plug somebody else in there. And I mean, hell, Demolition. Okay, one of my all-time favorite tag teams from the old WWF days. Axe and Smash. You know, Smash was not always played by Barry Darso. When Demolition first came along as a tag team, there was somebody else by the name of Randy Cully who was playing the role of Smash for at least a couple of weeks, if not longer. And then I don't remember what happened, but Cully went goodbye. He disappeared, and they brought in Barry Darso to become Smash, and they went on to become one of the most successful tag teams in company history. So this is a team that hasn't even made it to the main roster yet. I doubt many people would even realize. If they could find somebody else who's not doing much on NXT and who needs a bit of a push or needs something to help get them going, plugging them into a tag team might not be the worst idea. Maybe they can plug somebody else in there and then bring the Ascension up in a few months. I would hate to see the team just disappear because of what happened here. Let's switch gears and talk about Impact Wrestling from this past Thursday night. I enjoyed Impact this week, although there were some dumb things that really did not make any sense at all. Like, for example, the announcement that TNA is bringing next year's Lockdown pay-per-view to San Antonio, Texas at the Alamo Dome. Yes, the same Alamo Dome that WWE fit 60,000 people in for the Royal Rumble back in 1997. With hometown hero Shawn Michaels, no less, wrestling in the main event, and they still could not fill that building up. I mean, when I saw the commercial on Impact Thursday for this, I literally shouted, "What?" at my TV screen when I saw it. I mean, I am all for taking TNA shows on the road and out of the Impact zone. I think they should do that more often, but I have no idea what they were thinking when they made this decision. The only thing I could think, and I've had people email me to tell me this, is that they have this new venue that's part of the Alamo Dome called the Illusions Theater, which can be configured to seat anywhere from 3,700 to 11,000 people. And it's, you know, it's probably similar, I would guess, to the Felt Forum, which is actually now just called the Theater at Madison Square Garden. That at least sounds more plausible to me, that they would put it in the smaller venue within the bigger venue. You know, TNA's production people are usually very good at taking a small crowd in a big arena and spreading them out enough and lighting it in such a way to where it looks practically full. They did that when they took Impact to the UK, for example, at the beginning of the year. But these people are not magicians. You know, you're not going to be able to do that in a stadium that seats 70,000 plus people. I mean, that's like saying if WWE can do WrestleMania next year at MetLife Stadium, then we can do Slammiversary there and then gather all the TNA fans in the end zone and put a giant curtain around them. You know, it just doesn't work. At least with this Illusions Theater, it's an appropriate name because they can give the illusion that they actually have more people than they do. So that at least makes a little more sense. But they haven't said one way or the other if that's the plan. All TNA has said is that Lockdown is coming to the Alamo Dome. Most people look at that and go, oh, the Alamo Dome fits 70,000 people. Why are they doing this? So I'm just assuming that's what they're going to end up doing because, I don't know, when I first saw that, it just sounded like suicide to me. And by that, I don't mean Frankie Kazarian in a mask. I mean just company suicide. So, but still, Impact, pay-per-views, they should go on the road more often. Again, maybe not to a place quite that big, but anytime they get out of the Impact zone is nonetheless a positive thing. You just have to be very careful, though, because it can blow up in your face. You don't want your company to come across looking minor league. I guess that's kind of my concern with this, which is why I just freaked out when I saw that. It's great to get out and go elsewhere, but do it in a way where people don't look at you and go, wow, these guys are in a place where they just shouldn't be, and this just doesn't look right. You know, I was at the TNA house show here in Brooklyn. They had it at a baseball stadium in July, and the first show, I've been at all three shows they've done, and the first one did very well. It still did not fill the stadium. The baseball stadium fit about 7,500 is the capacity, and that first show did about 5,500. Still looked great, but, you know, the next summer it did less, this summer it did even less, and you know, when you have all that empty space, it doesn't look good. So they have to be very mindful of that, I think, when they go on the road. By the way, Lockdown is taking place in March next year, and TNA is doing away with their Against All Odds pay-per-view in February. I believe they're also doing away with their September pay-per-view before Bound for Glory. So they're cutting back on the number of pay-per-views. It's something I wish WWE would also do. You know, it's kind of like the whole announcer thing. When TNA brought in Todd Kennelly as an announcer and they were doing the different announce teams, which they're kind of not doing that now. Now it's just one three-man booth that they have. But at least Mike Tenay is no longer the straight play-by-play guy, which I just felt he was never all that good, quite frankly, as a straight play-by-play guy. But they're taking all these ideas that I've suggested for WWE, and TNA is doing it. So it's good that somebody is doing these things. I just wish WWE would take a cue and do the same thing. So let's get into Impact here. The show opened with Hulk Hogan hobbling to the ring. He was in no mood to be trifled with on this show, not in a good mood. He called out Bully Ray, who was not happy about the fact that even after all this time, Hogan still does not trust him, even after he tagged with Sting at Bound for Glory and didn't turn on him and all that stuff. And I am sticking to my guns on this. I still think that Bully Ray is in with Aces and Eights somehow. I don't buy that all of a sudden he goes from being the biggest heel in the company to one of the biggest baby faces. I think this whole thing with Brooke is a case of him trying to get with her so that, you know, she turns on her father and comes over to the dark side, so to speak. Anyway, Bully was about to tell Hogan who the number one man in his daughter's life really is. Brooke came out. She did some acting here, telling her dad that she's not a teenager anymore. It's not what you think. Hogan said he did not want his daughter dating any wrestlers. The last thing he wants is for Bully Ray to become the next Triple H. Hey, Hogan lived through WWF in the 80s with all the shit he probably saw the other guys doing and probably did himself. I don't blame him for not wanting his daughter to date a wrestler. Austin Aries popped up on the video screen to save this segment. He was backstage in Hogan's office, standing on top of his desk for some odd reason. He was surrounded by Zema Ion, Kid Cash, Kenny King. Hey, they brought Kenny King back. It's good to see that they dusted him off for this show, or at least I thought so, until Hogan later made him the first one cut from consideration from the X Division title match tonight. Why would you bring Kenny King back? Why would you fly him to Orlando for Impact, only to cut him and not even have him wrestle? Does this make any sense at all? They haven't even used the guy in months, which is just mind-boggling all by itself since he had a good showing. I mean, the fans were into him. And then they bring him back and do this? I mean, it's just stupid. Anyway, Aries said he was going to lay down and take a nap on Hogan's desk until he got back there. And then he made a joke about how it hurt his back, and he doesn't know how Brooke lays on this thing. And that was a money line right there. I very much enjoyed that. The fans also reacted big to it. Aries is just so great at being a dick. You know what I mean? He's just perfect in the role. He feels right at home. And to think, you know, WWE cut this guy from Tough Enough, before the season ever started because they didn't want it to be littered with indie stars. So the production company that put the roster together for the new season of Tough Enough, when they submitted it to Kevin Dunn and the production people in WWE, they took one look at it and they saw Austin Aries and a few other guys and they said, nope, we don't want these guys on the show. Who's left from that show now? A drunk Funkadactyl. Bunch of morons those people are. Actually, it was probably for the better, because as full of himself as Austin Aries can be, apparently both behind the scenes and on camera, he would not last 10 seconds backstage in that company. He would last about as long as Caval did. So I think in the end, things worked out for the better. Bobby Roode beat Christian York in a nice little match. York is just enormous. He could stand to learn from Chris Masters, I think, and just lose some muscle. He just looks very stiff when he moves around in the ring. But, again, nice little match. Backstage in the janitor's closet, we heard from Aces and Eights. We learned that Luke Gallows, or I guess I should start calling him Doc. Doc will face Kurt Angle next week. I want somebody to walk up to him and just say, what's up, Doc? It's just such an easy comedy line. I'm surprised nobody's done it already. D-Von is pissed because Samoa Joe is the TV champion. D-Von never actually lost the TV title, so he wants it back. RVD never actually lost his world title either. So, you know, shouldn't he be even more pissed? You would think he would be even more upset. RVD is a very mellow guy, though. You know, he doesn't let things bother him. I don't see him get angry very often. Have you ever met an angry pothead before? I don't think so. RVD should hook D-Von up. He'll feel a lot better. Actually, that could be TNA's strategy now that I think about it. If TNA is looking for a way to disarm the Aces and Eights or infiltrate the Aces and Eights, just send RVD over there. Send RVD over to get high with all of them, and when they let their guard down, that's when you swoop in and you nail them. See, RVD could be TNA's secret weapon against the Aces and Eights. Christopher Daniels and Kazarian, the best damn tag team in all of wrestling, are now calling themselves Bad Influence. That sounds like the name of a really bad 80s rock band. They faced a team of James Storm and AJ Styles. They should call themselves Losers, Inc., because that's exactly how they've been booked of late. Although they did win this match here. AJ is still doing this deal where he's missing moves, he's very sloppy in the ring, and Storm is trying to get him to snap out of his funk. And he pinned Daniels in the end with the last call super kick. There was a fantastic moment during this match where Daniels and Kazarian broke into the Gangnam Style dance. And on commentary, Taz just goes, "I can't wait until this Gangnam Style thing passes because it sucks." I thought that was hilarious. Just the way he said it so matter-of-factly. He left no doubt whatsoever what he thinks of that song. It sucks. The next segment made my head spin. We returned to Hulk Hogan's office, where it was time to decide who would be wrestling RVD in the main event for the X Division title. Kid Cash cut a very passionate promo, making the case for why he deserved a shot. But in the end, who did Hogan choose for this great opportunity? Why, of course, he chose Austin Aries. The same Austin Aries who's been insulting him for weeks, and who's been calling his daughter a slut on TV. On this very show, in fact, not more than an hour ago. On that desk, in that office, with a passion, and I want to see them have their ass handed to them, like, really get the shit kicked out of them, RVD would not be at the top of my list of people to deliver that beatdown, especially in a straight wrestling match. I mean, maybe if it were no DQ or something, you could possibly make that argument, but it wasn't. Why even make it a title match? Why not tell Aries it was non-title, just to fuck with him? Or if you really want somebody to lay a beating on him, you know, Hogan seems to have taken a liking recently to Matt Morgan, right? "Oh, he's finally getting it, brother. He's getting it." Why not tell Aries, "You get no title match. Instead, I'm going to put you in a match with Morgan. Let Morgan go out there and destroy him." I know Morgan already had a match next with Doug Williams, but so what? I'm also no Matt Morgan fan, by the way. I find him to be incredibly boring. When he came out wearing that cape for his match, Hogan's cape, and it really is Hogan's cape, by the way, that he wore out to Shea Stadium 30 years ago, whatever it was, for his match against Andre the Giant. Morgan looked so ridiculous wearing this thing. It kills any intimidating aura he may have about him. You know, he's just got to ditch the cape. He's just got to get rid of it. And ditch Joey Ryan while you're at it. I kind of liked the pairing of the two of them at first, but now I just don't understand the purpose of putting them together at all. I think it's hurting Morgan more than it's helping Joey Ryan. Backstage, Bruce Pritchard was freaking out over the fact that Al Snow apparently was missing. Nobody could find him. They didn't know where he was. His wife didn't even know where he was. D'Lo Brown offered to stand in for Snow during the next gut check segment, especially since he does the gut check judging on the road for TNA at live events. And so Pritchard agreed. D'Lo is totally in with Aces and Eights. I mean, I'm sure most of you probably have figured the same thing up to this point. They've dropped little clues and little hints here and there. This was the most glaring clue yet. I predict that at this point in the show, before the gut check segment even took place, once I knew that D'Lo was going to be in it, I predicted that he would probably be the deciding vote that gives Wes Briscoe a contract. And sure enough, I was right. Briscoe came out for his gut check. Pritchard voted yes to give him a contract. Predictably, Taz voted no. I was hoping Briscoe would start doing the Gangnam Style dance at this point just to piss off Taz. He did not. So the deciding vote fell upon the shoulders of D'Lo Brown, who ended up saying yes. So Briscoe gets his TNA contract. Kurt Angle and Garrett Bischoff ran down to celebrate with Briscoe. The fans were also very happy. It amazes me that the fans either don't see the turn coming, or much like the deal with Joe Park, you know, where they clearly knew that he was Abyss, but they played along with that storyline anyway when it was in full force, you know. The fans, they're just playing along with things the way they should, which is cool, you know, not to see the fans go against the grain for a change just for the sake of going against the grain. I figure D'Lo, Briscoe, and Garrett as well are probably all part of Aces and Eights, and poor Kurt Angle does not see the epic beatdown that's coming his way. So Maybe somebody can tweet Kurt and just give him a heads up on that. Austin Aries and Rob Van Dam for the X Division title. They had a good match, as you figure they would. Finish was kind of silly because Aries had Van Dam beat. He shoved him off the top rope. Van Dam landed on the guardrail on the outside. So Aries goes out there, he throws him back in the ring, and instead of going for a cover, to win the championship, he decides it's more important at this particular juncture of the match to grab the microphone and start taunting Brooke Hogan some more. He said RVD was laying flat on his back, breathing heavy, his hair was all mussed, just like Brooke. And so this brought out an angry Bully Ray who went to deliver a powerbomb on Aries. He escaped. And then Hulk Hogan appeared on top of the ramp with what appeared to be bloodshot eyes. Either that or he was just very tired. But his eyes looked almost bloodshot to me. And so Aries was caught in a trap here. You know, he's in the aisleway. He can't go up the ramp because he's got the 60-year-old man waiting for him. So I guess he feels like he can't go up that way. He couldn't go back in the ring because Bully was waiting for him. And why Bully didn't just run after him, I have no idea. So, Aries is caught. What's going to happen? Well, that's a good question because they never actually showed Austin Aries again. Instead, the camera focused on shots of Bully and shots of Hogan staring at each other. And that's how we went off the air. So I presume that Aries bailed into the crowd, but I guess we'll never know. You know, maybe he made like one of those foot soldiers from the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies. You know, he threw down one of those little orb things that bursts into smoke and allows you to flee without being seen. I don't know what the hell those things are called. That's the best explanation I can come up with. You know, a few more weeks like this, and I'm going to get real sick of Hogan dominating this show. I said last week, I gave the whole thing a pass. I was very entertained by what they did last week. Austin Aries is the MVP of this storyline so far, and I'm very happy that even after losing the championship to Jeff Hardy, they didn't reduce his role, they didn't knock him down the card, like somebody like poor James Storm or somebody like that. You know, he's featured very prominently still, Aries is, on the show in the main storyline. That's cool. I like that. But again, you know, it wasn't good when the McMahons used to dominate TV every week. It wasn't good when it was aces and eights all the time, and they seem to have dialed that back a little bit in the past few weeks, which is good. I don't need to see Hulk Hogan's bloodshot eyes and wrinkled up face as this show fades to black every single week. So, right now, fine. But if 4 weeks from now we're still looking at Hogan in every segment and Hogan ending the show, it's going to be time to pull the plug on this because that's not a good thing. It's not like Hogan's going to wrestle a match. That's not where this is going. Hogan clearly cannot wrestle a match and should not wrestle a match. They have to be very careful here with how much Hogan they give us on TV every week. The good news is that TNA announced not one but three matches for next week's Impact, which I believe is the final live Impact of the year, if I'm not mistaken. You know, this is what WWE should be doing. You know, not announcing stuff on WWE.com 4 hours before Raw. You know, promote some matches for the fans to look forward to a week in advance. I like that. I guess that's hard to do, though, when, you know, Vince McMahon probably goes to the men's room to take a crap on Monday afternoon and scribbles a bunch of random matches down on a piece of toilet paper to give to the writers for that night's show. Not exactly masters of long-term booking in that company, but on Impact this upcoming week, it'll be Samoa Joe and D-Von for the TV title. That match was made official. Kurt Angle and Doc will have a match. And Big Six-Man Tag, AJ Styles, James Storm, and Jeff Hardy will meet Bobby Roode, Christopher Daniels, and Kazarian. So those are your matches for Impact coming up this past week. Let's get on to the mailbag questions here. I have a lot of them this week. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. We have a shout-out here at the top here I just want to get to. Kind of sad here, but one of our loyal listeners, Scott Silvernagel, who I believe was the one who was kind enough to get that clip for us of Gangrel a few months back, giving the sound off a shout-out, which was very cool. Scott writes in, "Hey, Solomonster, I was wondering if I can get a shout-out for my unborn son, Jacob. We recently went for our gender ultrasound and found we are having a boy, but got some bad news as well. We learned that our child has congenital diaphragmatic hernia, a very serious condition in which the diaphragm does not form properly and has a hole, allowing his organs to push into his chest, causing the left lung to not develop properly. A few days after he's born, he will require major surgery." Well, I'm very sorry to hear that, Scott. you know, that's got to be every parent's worst nightmare, I would imagine, to get news like that. So so major prayers for little Jacob and for you and your wife. Hopefully the surgery will correct the condition, and he'll be able to live a normal life. And then you can write into the show again, asking for another shout-out for Jacob after his successful operation. Lee Wess, listener since episode one, celebrating his 27th birthday today. Happy birthday, Lee. He says, Zack Ryder's Z True Long Island story will reach 100 episodes soon, but yet Zack is nowhere near the main event spot. Do you think after passing his milestone, Zack Ryder should go heel, citing that even with all of his success in social media, it all meant nothing to his status in WWE, and from now on, Zack will only look out for Zack? I would hardly say that his YouTube show meant nothing, since he'd probably be unemployed right now or in TNA if it were not for that show. He had a good run. I mean, he won the U.S. title. He sold a shitload of merchandise that he never had before, probably still does. I think he did pretty well for himself. You know, I think as quite frankly, in his role as a mid-card guy, he overachieved. And the thing is, and I said this at the time as well, he was never going to be a main eventer with this gimmick. I mean, frankly, I don't see Ryder as a main event guy anyway. I mean, what is with this notion that everybody deserves to be in the main event? Oh, this guy, it's not fair. He's not going to be a main eventer. This guy's not going to be a main eventer. Not everybody deserves to be in the main event. That position is really only occupied by, what, 6, maybe 7 guys at any one time? You know, it's an elite group for a reason. You know, sometimes it can be politically motivated. Some people who deserve to be there are held down. But, you know, Ryder is an okay wrestler. He's not particularly good on promos. But he's a creative guy with his show and everything, and he's got some personality. He's got a good fan following. You know, really, he should be a solid mid-card guy in the company, and I'd say right now he's just below that. You know, could he be more prominently featured? Yes, he can be. They could be doing more with him. But he was never going to be a main eventer, being some goofy comedy character. And as far as him turning heel, I think the time to do it would have been after his supposed best friend, John Cena, was caught kissing Eve. You know, that would have been the best time to have him turn on Cena and try to use John Cena to give the rub to Zack Ryder as a heel to get him going. You know, they could turn him now and have him beat up Santino, which would be an easy way to get heat, but then you sacrifice what you've got with his YouTube series, and if you take that away, what does he really have left? Can he get over on his own enough as a bad guy? He hasn't shown me that he can't. He doesn't exactly come off as tough. I look at him more like The Miz, who I can never take seriously as a main eventer. I still have trouble taking him seriously. So, again, this notion that, well, you know, Zack is being held down, his show hasn't done him much good, he's done very well for himself because of that YouTube show, and like I said, I think he's overachieved, quite frankly. Kenneth writes in, I've asked my friend, and we agree, that entering the Royal Rumble is not considered coming out of retirement. Okay, let me stop you right there before I even get to the rest of this email. If you retire, and then you come back and wrestle again, that is coming out of retirement. In fact, I would argue that taking major bumps of any kind, even in an angle, could also be considered constituted as coming out of retirement. That Undertaker Triple H Hell in a Cell match at WrestleMania this year, that I saw live, okay, that was practically a triple threat match at certain times with Shawn Michaels in there, okay? So I don't buy that just because it's not a singles match or a tag team match, it doesn't count. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that. Back to Kenneth's email here. He says, my idea is that HBK makes a surprise appearance in next year's Royal Rumble and finally locks up with The Rock. This is assuming that Rock loses to CM Punk, and I think he will, and the Rumble goes on last. HBK and Rock could throw a bunch of guys out of the ring, and before the next person comes out, they could finally have the dream match we have been waiting for. Sure, it won't be a 30-minute classic, but I don't think HBK would come out of retirement anyway, and this can give fans a sample of what might have been. What do you think? Here's my advice. Let it go. Shawn Michaels and The Rock will never, ever wrestle each other. It's just not going to happen. It would have been great to see 10 years ago, but that ship has sailed. Rock is not going to be in the Rumble match anyway, so I'm not even sure what sense that would make. You know, there's a better chance of CM Punk entering the Royal Rumble after losing the title, you know, so that he could try to get his rematch at WrestleMania. And I'm not saying that's going to happen either, but I could see that long before I see Rock entering the Royal Rumble. So, yeah, not going to happen. Robert from Norwich, England, listener since episode one. At the moment, I'm sitting in my office at work reminiscing about past episodes of The Sound Off. I remember in a previous episode, you came up with a product idea for WWE of a Money in the Bank lunchbox, which I think would be a real winner. Since I'm pretty sure WWE listens to your show, I thought I would share a creative idea of my own, which I would be sure to buy if it was for sale this Christmas. I want your listeners to all close their eyes. Now imagine you are tucked up in bed with your John Cena wrestling buddy, your Randy Orton bed sheets, and Rey Mysterio light shade. I hope Noah and Brian are listening. I'm looking at you boys. You're dreaming about the latest episode of Raw when you are suddenly awoken by the sound of some familiar music playing. You look across the room to see a Ryback action figure pumping its fist up and down, shouting, "Wake up!" I know this type of alarm would certainly get me out of bed in the morning. What do you think? Not a bad idea. Not bad at all. That's right up there with a Ryback baby bib that reads, "Feed me more." I still think that my Money in the Bank lunchbox is a better idea, though. Between that and the ice cream bars, this company is leaving a lot of money on the table. I mean, they're leaving millions of dollars on the table, as the primetime players might say. So they've got to get going on that. Ian from Dublin, Ireland, or I guess if I pronounce it correctly, I suppose I should call it Dublin. Dublin, Ireland writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I've been a huge fan of the show since the days of the Slobber Monster on SE Scoops Live. Unlike Raw, I enjoy it each week. My question is regarding CM Punk on Talking Dead. The Walking Dead and wrestling are two completely different forms of entertainment. The Walking Dead is always exciting, and you cannot wait for the next episode, while Raw is a death sentence." Well, I wouldn't go that far. "From my understanding, Punk pushed to be on Talking Dead. Do you think WWE should let their superstars off the company's leash to pursue media attention on their own, doing what they actually like rather than just phoning it in? I appreciate that Punk pushed to do something he wanted to do. It was not a USA Network program. It was an AMC program, one that has a huge dedicated following, which could pay off as a great PR move for WWE. I agree, it was nice to see Punk on Talking Dead, you know, discussing something he clearly is passionate about. He loves comic books, and he loves the show. So do I. It's a great show. Tonight is actually the mid-season finale. I'm very much looking forward to that. But, you know, look, on the show last weekend, they identified him as a WWE superstar, which gives them some publicity with a completely different audience for a show that is one of the most popular, right? Walking Dead, zombies, I mean, that's the thing right now. Walking Dead did something like 13 million viewers for its last episode on cable. That is unbelievable. So for Punk to be connected to that in any way gives WWE a little bit of rub. That's a good thing. Now, why WWE would drag their feet on this or make things so difficult that Punk had to go around their back just to book himself on the show just amazes me. You know, I can understand the company wanting to have its talent clear stuff like this with them in advance. I get that. And maybe in this case, it had something to do with the very fact that it was an AMC show and not USA or some other NBC Universal property. You know, WWE is part of that whole NBC Universal family, and maybe I don't believe AMC is. It's a completely different cable network. I think it's more an issue, though, of WWE being paranoid, that if they loosen their grip on these guys just a little bit and let them start booking themselves for outside projects, because God forbid, you know, an independent contractor should be allowed to do such a horrible thing, they're worried that they may turn into the next Stacy Keibler or the next Chris Jericho, who ends up leaving the company to pursue other interests. I say, just use it to your advantage. You want to do X, Y, and Z? Fine. But just make sure that WWE gets publicity out of it, or you get to promote the next pay-per-view. Get something out of it. There's a lot of very articulate, attractive divas and superstars on the roster, and I think it would actually help the company's image to get these people out there even more. There's a certain stereotype about wrestlers that I think still permeates our culture, where they're just a bunch of stupid, toothless, tatted up muscle heads who do nothing but shoot steroids and drink muscle milk all day. But then you see CM Punk on Talking Dead, or you see Miz and Eve on The Soup on E, or John Cena doing his Make-A-Wish stuff, and you realize, you know, hey, these guys aren't dummies after all. So I agree. I think they should loosen their grip a little bit, let them get out there. I think they could be very good representatives of the company outside of, as you said, just USA Network shows and whatever, you know, PR opportunities that WWE would get for them. Adrian from Melbourne, Australia writes, in episode 248 will be 100 episodes since I started listening to your show, although since then I have listened to far more than 100 shows to keep up. Next year will be Kurt Angle's 7th year in TNA, the same amount of time he spent in WWE. My question is, do you view Kurt as a TNA guy or a WWE guy? For example, Goldberg and DDP are WCW guys. John Cena and Randy Orton are viewed as WWE guys. When Adrian wrote into me, I did not realize it had been that long for Kurt in TNA. 7 years. That's a long time. Going there probably was the best thing he ever did, because when he left WWE, he was in rough shape. And some people probably didn't even think he'd live another 7 years the way he was going. But always view Sting, for example, as a WCW guy, more than a TNA guy. Even if Sting were to TNA there, you know, to surpass his time in WCW, he'll always be a WCW guy first. Hulk Hogan, most people will. David Jones has a special shout-out. Congrats on the anniversary a few weeks back. I had meant to write you before then, but got busy with my job promotion and an anniversary of my pay-per-views we have gone to. She also has become a fan of the Sound Off, and we enjoy listening to it together when we are not working. I was hoping with this letter I could get a shout-out to my lovely and awesome girlfriend. I never thought I'd find a girl who'd be so willing to go to a wrestling pay-per-view, and hope that we have many more in our future, just like I hope to hear many more sound-offs in the years to come. So that comes from David. Congratulations to him and his girlfriend. That's very cool. Hold on to her. Marcus says, first off, a belated congratulations on 5 years. Awesome to see how the show has grown. On to my question. What were your thoughts on the American Badass Undertaker? I personally did not like it. In my opinion, the Undertaker character should be such a revered figure and distinctly different from all the other superstars. For some reason, when I looked at him as the American Badass, I did not see the character that you should be scared of. I saw him as just another guy. Plus, transitioning off the most ruthless Undertaker phase, Lord of Darkness, it just did not seem right to me. What do you think? A lot of people don't like Biker Taker, as I call him. Paul Bearer has said before, in interviews, or an interview that I remember reading at some point way back when, that he also was not all that fond of the character. And I can understand that, because Paul Bearer came in with Undertaker and became a very popular act. They were together for the first 6 years of their run in WWE. And that's the character I'm sure that Paul Bearer most associates with, is the Dead Man Undertaker. Vince McMahon would not even let his announcers acknowledge the fact that The Undertaker and Triple H had a match at WrestleMania X7. You know, in modern WWE history, that match they had at WrestleMania last year in Atlanta was their first match, their first WrestleMania meeting. The WrestleMania 17 match never happened, because he didn't want to draw attention to the fact that it was a different Undertaker. He did not like that version of the character. You know, when he first came back as the American Badass, I didn't like it either. It was so totally different than the Dead Man gimmick he had always portrayed. I just felt like they were betraying the character in a way. I was one of the people who were dying to see him return to the Dead Man in 04, and I was kind of disappointed when he showed up with the stupid fedora as some sort of hybrid Dead Man Biker Taker mix. But then, you know, I came to appreciate what they did there, because if you'll recall, the last time we saw Undertaker before that, he was buried alive at Survivor Series by his brother. So it actually kind of made sense that when he reappeared, he would be this sort of undead, you know, zombie version of Biker Taker. Now, I look back on that era, and I have a fondness, not necessarily for the American Badass, but more for the Big Evil version of his character, the heel that we saw in 2002 and 2003. He just came off as such a badass. He was doing the best promo work of his career, because he didn't have to talk about the creatures of the night and stealing souls and all the supernatural crap. You know, that segment where he went to the training facility, Tracks, I think they called it, and terrorized poor David Flair. This was before WrestleMania 18. He was preparing for the match with Flair. So he went down to this training facility, and he just terrorized Ric Flair's son, and beat the piss out of him in the shower stall. And then he just sits down beside this kid. Okay, so now Undertaker slumps down. He's sitting down in the shower. David Flair is sitting right next to him. He's beaten. He's all bloodied up. Flair is, like, half dead. He's asking Undertaker, why are you doing this? What are you doing? What are you doing? And Taker just goes, I'm kicking your ass. What do you think I'm doing? And then he punches him in the face again. Just great stuff. I still remember that to this day. So I didn't like the American Badass too much either, but Big Evil, I think, is a very underrated character that doesn't get enough credit. It was one that commanded respect. You know, when he beat Jeff Hardy in that infamous ladder match on Raw. And then afterwards, he actually shook Jeff Hardy's hand and showed the kid some respect, which normally you didn't see heels do. You'd expect him to just beat the crap out of Hardy, but he didn't do that. Same thing with John Cena. John Cena made his debut on SmackDown in 2002. He lost to Kurt Angle, but he had a very good match, largely because he was in there with Kurt Angle, but he hung with him. And they had this backstage segment later in the show where Cena's talking to, I don't remember if it was Rikishi or whoever it was, and Undertaker all of a sudden shows up. Everybody gets all scared and walks away. Cena's now there by himself. He looks like he's about to shit his pants. And Undertaker asks him what his name is. He says, my name is John Cena. And Undertaker tells him, good job. And he walks off. I liked it. Again, it was a weird heel character. And I say weird heel character because that's not something WWE does or used to do very often. Every heel in that company, almost every heel, was always a chicken shit heel. You know, they kind of fit a certain formula. Ric Flair was a respected heel when he was in the Horsemen in the old NWA. When he came over to WWF, he became a chicken shit heel, just like everybody else. Undertaker bucked that trend. You know, he was different. And I like that version of the character. The American Badass, not so much. Matt wants to know, what's your take on the pseudonyms that WWE creates for their developmental wrestlers? When I recently read that Pac's new name is now Adrian Neville, I just shook my head in disgust. There seems to be a trend in WWE where they give guys these generic, regular-sounding names, and I don't see the logic behind it. Furthermore, how come every wrestler has to have a first name and a last name? Why has WWE completely done away with the fictitious pseudonyms like The Rock, The Undertaker, Kane, and X-Pac? It's what helps define you and makes you stand out. A good name can help an audience identify with and remember a young up-and-comer. I think the names they come up with today for developmental guys are boring and outright shameful. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Well, I agree that, you know, your name is very important. Not everybody is a Dolph Ziggler who can overcome a shitty name simply based on pure talent and athletic ability. But I'm actually going to give WWE some credit on this. I once did a podcast where I savaged them, just ripped them apart for all of the god-awful names they were giving people in developmental. I mean, remember Husky Harris, Eli Cottonwood. Okay, that still to me is the best worst name I think anybody in developmental was given. So when I see names like Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose and Antonio Cesaro and Adrian Neville, I really don't think they're all that bad. You know, apparently Neville's name comes from some retired Manchester United soccer player, much like, remember, Kenny Dykstra. Kenny Dykstra's Spirit Squad, his name came from an ex-baseball player. And that was a far worse name than Adrian Neville. So these names, you know, boring and dull as they may be, are actually an improvement on the names they were giving these guys before. And who's to say that, you know, once they start developing their own personality on TV, that they don't end up with a fun nickname that sticks? I mean, Dwayne Johnson was Rocky Maivia first before he morphed into The Rock. Steve Austin was the Ringmaster before he became Stone Cold. But you do have a point. I mean, think about it. Think back to your youth. If you grew up a WWF fan in the Northeast, like I did, what are the names that you still remember the most? It's probably guys like Hulk Hogan, Jake the Snake, the Macho Man, the Ultimate Warrior, the Big Boss Man, Mr. Perfect, Demolition, all very cool names. But one reason why I don't mind it being the way it is now is because it's a different era that we live in. It's an era where, you know, UFC is still very popular. And while some of those fighters also have cool nicknames like the Axe Murderer and the Iceman, you know, it's mostly a bunch of fighters with regular sounding names, and they do tremendous business. Even if it is down from its peak of a couple of years ago, UFC still does tremendous business. One of the biggest fights of the year in 2013, if UFC can book it, is going to be between two guys named Anderson Silva and George St. Pierre. not exactly menacing-sounding names, although Silva does have a nickname called the Spider, but, you know, they're big stars, and they'll do a great job of making that fight feel special, and they'll make an insane amount of money off of it. So people want real. They don't want cartoons. I would rather these new guys have normal-sounding names rather than absurd ones that just kill their career right out of the gate before they even have a chance to take off. This shout-out comes from Jay, part of the Fantastic Four, on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and iTunes, and a listener since an episode in the 30s. I would like to request a special birthday shout-out to the lady of my life, Ashley. She does not like wrestling, but will watch it with me because she knows I love it. I like to listen to your podcast right before bed and fall asleep listening to your rants. She eventually started requesting that I play your podcast every night because she watched the product enough to like your opinions, and she says your voice is soothing and helps relax her to sleep. Well, she's not the first female to tell me that, but your show brings us together on something she normally does not like. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work. And again, that comes from Jay, so thank you, Jay, and thank you, Ashley. I love getting emails like that. So if you have emails, feed me more. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send your questions, comments, your shout-outs, your ATM passwords, all that stuff. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle, as we rack up more followers. I always appreciate that, and I'm most active on Twitter, I would say. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the official profile page for The Solomonster Sounds Off. You can send me a friend request on there. We, as always, have a lively debate and discussion happening when Raw goes on the air every week, major pay-per-views, all that stuff. So friend me on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It'll come right up. It is free. You subscribe, and every time a new episode goes up, you know how iTunes works. It automatically downloads for you. You don't have to do much. So subscribe to the show on there, and leave a review if you have a few seconds to spare. I always appreciate seeing that, and it helps the show. So that's going to do it for episode 248. I want to thank you, as always, for downloading the show. I very much appreciate it. We will be back next weekend with episode 249. I believe that is the... actually, no, it is not the final show before TLC. That is the week after, and we'll have to do predictions then. But next week is episode 249 as we approach the 250th episode of the show. We just keep racking through milestones here. Till next time, be well, stay safe. And we'll see you right back here next weekend for more of The Sound Off, exclusively on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, sir.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.